True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
This episode is sponsored by Madison Reed, the people who are transforming the way we color our hair, with beautiful, salon-quality, multidimensional hair color delivered to your door on your schedule. This is not your mother's hair color. Join the thousands of women who've fallen in love with Madison Reed and say goodbye to spending hours in the salon. Visit madison-reed.com and get 10% off plus free shipping on your first color with promo code BREWERY. That's madison-reed.com and promo code BREWERY. And today's show is also sponsored by HelloFresh. Please visit HelloFresh.com and use promo code TCB30, and you'll receive $30 off your first week of deliveries when you subscribe. David Brown, a man who masterminded the 1985 murder of his wife, died of natural causes in a prison hospital in 2014. He was 61. Now, Brown was in protective housing because of his notoriety for the killing of his fifth wife, Linda Brown.
I'm surprised he actually made it to 61. I mean, this guy smoked like a chimney.
Yeah, he was not a picture of health.
No.
No. He was accused of persuading two teenagers, one of them was his daughter, the other was his sister-in-law, and his lover, to kill his wife, Linda. Then he went on to collect $835,000 from the victim's insurance, including several policies started just months before her death. Now, Brown paid $350,000 in cash for a new house within 5 months of killing her, and shortly after, he took a sixth wife. So our story today would be absolutely unbelievable if it weren't true. David Brown was the very incarnate of evil, a sociopath with a sweet tooth, a weak stomach, an insatiable desire for cash, cigarettes, junk food, and adolescent girls.
Not necessarily in that order.
No. He spent his life manipulating people and scamming, in spite of the fact that he really had a great income and he was surrounded by people who adored him. But the only life he really valued was his own. So join us at the quiet end for Sugar and Spice, the murder of Linda Brown. So what do we have for a beer today?
Today we have a California beer. It's called Nelson. It's an IPA brewed by Alpine Brewing Company in Alpine, California.
I like when people give a beer a name like a person, like George, Nelson, Tom. That's cool.
I think this was kind of named after the hops.
Oh, okay.
Nelson Sauvin.
But it sounds like a person's name,
so
that's neat.
Well, in our area, Hillstead Farm in Vermont names their beers after ancestors of the family.
What are some of those names?
Emily, Edward.
I like that.
I mean, just simple first names.
Very nice. Do you think there'll ever be a beer named Jill?
Sure, I'll brew it for you.
Thank you.
Okay. So Nelson is an American IPA. And for those of you who haven't listened before, American IPAs tend to be pale gold to red amber in color. They tend to be hoppy with herbal and or citric hops, a little bit on the bitter side, but still some malt that balances out the bitterness. Now, Nelson is brewed with the Nelson hops, but also has some rye in it. And that leads to a very nice beer. It's a gold-colored beer. There's a white head that retained well. It's got a peppery rye aroma, some tropical fruit, some citrus. When you taste it, grapefruit, pineapple, kind of spicy peppers type stuff, that's the rye. It's a medium-bodied, nicely bitter beer. Fairly popular IPA.
Okay, let's open it up and drink it, you think?
Yeah, we should.
Okay, let's do it.
Okay, Jill, let's head on down to the quiet end. We're sticking with pint glasses again.
Okay.
I know we've been kind of snifterless lately.
Yeah. Have you ever thought of maybe doing a flight for an episode? Is there a way to do like a flight from the region instead of one beer?
Well, I sure there is.
That'd be cool.
Because as we look down at the quiet end, there's a bunch of guys drinking flights.
Well, that's what made me think of it, yeah.
Ah, and they all look like the stereotypic beer geek. You know, they're kind of beefy looking. They've got full beards.
Yeah.
They've got flannel shirts on. They're in their 20s and 30s.
Yeah.
You know, that's the stereotype of the beer nerd.
Yeah, they look serious about it too, don't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Except flights have good points and bad points.
Okay.
You know, so let's suppose you go to a place you've never been to before. And you'd like to try several different beers because you've not had any of their beers. You know, a flight sounds like a reasonable way to do it, right?
Yeah, right.
You get these 4-ounce pours, you know, 4 or 5 of them, and you can sample different beers.
Sure.
So that's the good stuff. But the bad part about that is that your palate gets tired out. So you say you have an IPA, a stout, a pilsner, maybe a couple other styles. You know, you drink a couple of those, and you don't know what you're drinking anymore.
Well, don't you do it in a particular order, though, well, to the more palate-wrecking beers?
You're supposed to. But even with that, I mean, even if you follow a pecking order of drinking beers, it's tough to keep in mind what you're drinking all the time.
So what's the best way to taste beers, then?
Well, I think the best way is maybe to do short pours, like a 6-8 ounce pour,
yeah,
of a couple beers.
All right, and not too many at one sitting.
No, because
okay,
that way you can appreciate what you're drinking, and have a recognition of what you're drinking.
All right, good advice from a sage beer drinker.
That's me.
Okay.
All right.
All righty.
Let's get on with it.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1985, the year this occurred, there were 13,031 deaths in Orange County, California. The coroner's office investigated a little over 6,000 of those deaths, and of those, 112 were determined to be homicides. So this particular one was Linda Brown, and she was one of the 112. She's 23 years old, was found shot to death on Ocean Breeze Drive, March 19th, in the city of Garden Grove. So Ocean Breeze Drive, where the killing occurred, was just minutes from the police station, and it was over 10 miles from the beach, or the actual ocean. So I'm thinking it might be tough for those ocean breezes to reach there.
Yeah, you wouldn't think there'd be a lot of ocean breezes 10 miles away.
But it's a nice name anyway.
It is.
So Ocean Breeze Drive was just a block long, and there were 6 houses on each side of the street. These houses were built in the 60s and had very generous lots. The residents were mostly middle-aged family people who held jobs. Weeknights on Ocean Breeze Drive were usually pretty quiet. No street lights, dark out. You know, it's a quiet neighborhood. Dozen mm-hmm. houses. So David Brown called 911 from his house at 3:26 a.m. Police arrived at the house. The house was still. No shouting or hysterical people on the front lawn. Porch light was out, but there were some lights on in the front window.
Now, inside the house, a young blonde woman held a crying baby in her arms as she sobbed. An out-of-shape man who looked about 45 sat smoking on the living room couch. He told police he was David Brown, 32 years old, the husband of the victim.
So it's already apparent he's not aging well.
Right. I think my wife's been shot, David said. She's in the bedroom. I'm afraid to go look. Would you do that, officer? So that's strange, right there.
That's a pretty strange request, you know? He hadn't even gone into the bedroom.
He wouldn't, no. So the policeman was taken aback by this. He hadn't looked. David pointed the officer toward the master bedroom, and the officer could make out the bed across the room in the dark. He fixed his flashlight on a young woman with long blondish hair, and there was a massive amount of blood on her chest. It was soaking through her childish nightie with penguins skating in all directions. He put his fingertips to her carotid artery and felt nothing. He leaned over her face and felt no breath. Her chin and lips were covered with blood. Her sheets and blanket were flat, and they were neat, so there was no sign of a struggle.
None at all. And the paramedics arrived, and they initially thought they heard her gasping for air. So they lifted her from the bed to the floor to try to do CPR. They cut off her penguin nightie, leaving her only in her fuzzy blue socks. They inserted an airway, began chest compressions, but it was quickly realized that it was too late. She was dead.
Now, I was a little surprised they didn't feel a pulse and they did all this.
Yeah.
What's behind that, you think?
Well, I guess maybe she wasn't looking dead enough yet.
Maybe. She probably wasn't discolored too much.
Yeah.
Or...
And she wasn't
in rigor mortis.
She wasn't blue or that blue.
Right.
So maybe they figured they had a shot.
They must have. I mean, you could not feel a pulse and someone could still be retrievable if it's been a very short time.
If it's quick enough, yeah.
Yeah. Well, there was a revolver on the carpet between the door to the hallway and the bed, and that was assumed to be the murder weapon. Linda was taken out to an ambulance and rushed to the community hospital's ER. She was brought in just after 4 a.m. Now, a chest tube was inserted and she was given a blood transfusion. The surgeon made a final attempt to save her by opening her chest cavity and massaging her heart with his gloved hand.
Yeah, now, if you have to resort to that, this isn't going to be a good outcome. You know, cardiac massage hardly ever, maybe never, but at least I'll say hardly ever works.
Well, they made a valiant effort.
They certainly did.
And she's only 23.
Yeah.
Now, at 4:26 a.m., she was pronounced dead, although she probably had been dead for over an hour. The manner of her death was from two bullet wounds to her chest. Now, back in the house, Linda's sister Patty was sitting on the couch beside David Brown. Police separated the two and questioned them. Now, Patty Bailey was only 17, and she'd been living with her sister Linda and Linda's husband David since she was 12. The baby she held was Linda's daughter, Crystal. The police asked if anyone else lived there. David's 14-year-old daughter from a previous marriage, Cinnamon Brown, lived there, and she was missing. Patty said that she had seen Cinnamon run out the back door after hearing gunshots. David had been out of the house and returned just after the shooting. Now, both David and Patty told police that they believed Cinnamon was the one who shot Linda.
They heard the gunshots, or Patty heard the gunshots and saw Cinnamon running out.
That was her story,
so
yes.
That's the story.
Yeah.
So police searched the house, they searched the yard, they searched a small travel trailer that was parked next to the house. There was no sign of Cinnamon. David Brown, meanwhile, is chain-smoking, sitting on the couch, but when he spoke, he had a commanding voice. David seemed to have accepted that his daughter had been the shooter. He explained that he lived with Linda, their 8-month-old daughter, his sister-in-law Patty, and Cinnamon. Now, according to David, Patty and Linda's mother was a chronic alcoholic, so they had taken Patty in to live with them.
Yeah, and she'd been there for years. Now, the picture David painted of Cinnamon was of an angry girl who didn't fit in and who had resisted all of their attempts to help her. He said that he had tried to get her into counseling, but she'd refused. Cinnamon had been living in the travel trailer in the backyard, he said, for the past 3 weeks, because there had been problems between Linda and Cinnamon. Now, Linda had kicked her out of the house and told her to stay in the trailer. She had argued with Linda and refused to do the household chores that were assigned to her. Now, although she slept in the trailer, she would come inside for meals and to watch television.
Yeah, now we're going to find out down the road that these are selective memories of Cinnamon.
Yes, and distorted in some cases, yes.
Yeah, so keep that in mind.
Okay, I will.
So the night before, David had gone to bed with his wife, Linda, but he couldn't sleep. He had insomnia. So his solution was to go out for a drive. And he had taken a drive to the Circle K 24-hour market, which was a few blocks from their home. He bought a Dr. Pepper and a Hostess apple pie. After eating the pie, he went back in, bought some comic books. Then he drove to the beach to find a quiet spot to think. He stopped at a Denny's in Newport Beach to use the restroom. And he ended up being away from home for about an hour. Now, maybe you could think that he was trying to establish an alibi also.
You certainly could.
If you're a cynic.
Or if you're a reasonable human being.
Okay. Either or.
Either or. So when David arrived home and opened the front door, he said that Patty was at the front door crying and shaking, and she told him that Cinnamon had tried to kill her as well. Now it was light out when police found Cinnamon Brown. She was curled up in a doghouse out back inside a fenced pen. The Browns had 2 Cocker Spaniels, a white Pomeranian, and a tiny little blonde puppy. These were yappy dogs, and the puppy kept escaping from the pen. When an officer entered the pen to return the puppy, he saw Cinnamon's figure inside a barn-red doghouse. She was curled up in the fetal position with her long brown hair over her face.
Yeah, that's a strange place to find a kid, huh? Curled up in the doghouse?
Sure.
So Cinnamon was a pretty small girl, and she had a little bit still of baby fat. She was just entering adolescence.
Mm-hmm.
She clung to the policeman. She was obviously cold, sick, and sleepy. She had dried vomit on the front of her shirt and on her lips and chin. There was a piece of pink cardboard clutched in her hand that was wrapped in a purple ribbon. And the policeman pried it from her fingers and read the words printed on it that said, "Dear God, please forgive me. I didn't mean to hurt her."
Yeah, so this is a really strange scenario here, that the police have a lot to figure out of what's going on in this whole whole strange family dynamic.
They sure do. Here's a dead wife, a daughter found in a doghouse, basically with a note admitting guilt.
Right. And this strange man.
And this more than strange man.
So let's talk a little bit about who he was, David Brown, because that has a big impact on the case, obviously. He's at the center of all this.
He sure is. So David Brown was born in Phoenix, Arizona in 1952. He was the sixth of eight children. And his father, Arthur, was an auto mechanic, but he worked two jobs to try to support his family. And his mother, Manuela, was only 27 when she had her sixth child.
Big family.
Big family. Rapid onset of kids. An older sister of David's had died as an infant, and the firstborn child, Arthur Jr., died in an auto accident when he was 18.
Now, David, he looked more like his mother than his father, and her heritage was Hispanic. But David denied his Hispanic roots after he became an adult. He was actually quite racist, and he didn't hesitate to speak negatively about Hispanic people. He had more of an affinity for his father and turned to him in times of crisis. His mother was very opinionated, and she seemed to clash with David. He denied that he ever loved her and described her as selfish, greedy, and controlling. And as a teenager, he brought his mother to tears with cruel insults and jokes. So I would think this affects the way he treats women for the rest of his life.
I would take that.
It's an indication at least, right?
Absolutely. So when he was eight, the family moved to California. And he did end up going to see a counselor. I guess there was some behavioral issues.
Sounds like.
Related to the move or that were exacerbated by the move or something. But anyway, he went to a counselor. And he told the counselor about the wonderful relationships he had with his family members. But at the same time, he's describing his childhood as very horrific to other people. So he's putting on the best possible face for the counselor.
Yeah, yeah.
He claimed to have been beaten by gangs and molested by an older man in the park. He bragged that he went off to work at 11 years old, mowing lawns, washing dishes. And he left school in the eighth grade. So when he got to be 15, he had a steady girlfriend. Her name was Brenda. And she was also 15. Now, she turned out to be a petite brunette who also had an abusive home life. David saw himself as her rescuer and protector. He might have been overweight, having a face filled with acne, but
yeah,
he was her protector. He worked to become physically fit, and he wrote poetry to her.
Yeah, but he was very possessive of Brenda from the very start. He even made her wait outside of restrooms if he had to go inside. And they ran away together when he was 16. And at that point, they worked at Brenda's grandfather's hotel, painting and doing housekeeping. They got jobs together at a resort of guest cottages where Brenda cooked and David did the maintenance work.
Yeah, and that worked well for a while.
A little while.
However, David became paranoid and delusional. He began to think the people at this little resort were listening in on their phone conversations and they were watching them in their room. He believed in evil forces and ghosts. The more the two talked about it, he and Brenda, the more afraid they became. David finally called his parents, and they went to live with them.
So we're seeing some bizarre behaviors now from him.
Yeah, and he's in his mid-teens. I mean, this...
He's still very young.
These are big warning signs.
Yeah. And then he became obsessed with his health. He either believed or wanted other people to believe that he was dying of cancer. He told Brenda that he had colitis, which was eating him up from the inside. Now, this didn't affect his sexuality, however. He wanted sex 3 times a day. And at the same time, it was important to him that Brenda appear very prim and proper on the outside. He would not allow her even to wear makeup outside. So So this is all very red flag-ish, very worrisome.
It sure is.
Now, what about colitis?
Colitis is basically an inflammation of the large intestine.
So, which can be bad, if it can be serious.
It can be. There's one particularly serious one called ulcerative colitis that can lead to cancer if you don't have your colon removed.
Well, I'm just wondering if he went to doctors and actually had these diagnoses or just made them up, right?
I mean, colitis is kind of a general term anyway.
Right. So, you could probably trick a doctor with that if you just made up symptoms.
You could say, I have diarrhea, so I have colitis. It doesn't have to be anything necessarily bad.
To get that diagnosis?
Right.
Yeah. Well, Brenda became pregnant, and for a time they were on welfare. In 1970, the two got married, and Brenda gave birth to Cinnamon Darlene Brown in July of 1970. Brenda and David weren't even 18 yet when she was born. But he actually seemed to adore his daughter. He wanted a better life for his family, so he enrolled in the Work Incentive Program through the State Welfare Department and received his GED. His scores were well above average, so the WIN program sent him to Control Data Institute in Los Angeles. He worked part-time at a gas station, and they lived in a small apartment in Long Beach. David was determined to keep Brenda dependent upon him. He didn't want her to have a driver's license. He was jealous and possessive, accusing Brenda of being unfaithful. But actually, he was the one who was unfaithful.
He certainly was. So he had a new girlfriend whose name was Lori. He introduced Lori to Brenda, holding divorce papers.
That's right.
That's a shitty way to meet somebody, isn't it?
Well, sure. I don't think she needed to meet her at all.
Right. So this is the woman I'm going to marry, he said. Despite him being the one who wanted a divorce, David went after Brenda when she left with Cinnamon. He ended up holding a gun to her head and said if he couldn't have her, no one could. Then he dropped the gun and left. So they reconciled for about a week until Brenda caught him on the phone with Lori. She then kicked him out again, came back for his rifle the next day, and there was a struggle. Brenda was afraid to let him have the gun. He ended up being in his car, hitting Brenda with the car, not seriously injuring her. Brenda got custody of Cinnamon. Good.
Yeah.
And David had weekend visits.
Right. So they're broken up, and David goes ahead, and he marries Lori at this point. Now, his marriage to Lori lasted 4 years, and David found Linda while he was still married to Lori. First, he began by dating Linda's older sister, Pam, who was 10 years younger than he was. Then, little Linda caught his eye. She was slender and pretty, barely past puberty, and easily impressed by him. Now, Linda Bailey was only 13.
Yeah, so that's why she's impressed by him.
Well, of course. And this is what he looks for.
Yeah.
Now, like Brenda, Linda was one in the family of 11 children, and their mom was on welfare, a single mom, so they had hardly any money. Now, their mother, Ethel Bailey, was approached by David at first for some assistance. He asked if her teenage daughters could clean his house for an hourly wage. So who's going to turn that down?
No kidding.
Doctors had only given him 6 months to live, he said. His marriage was falling apart. His house was a mess. He desperately needed their help.
So his second marriage is falling apart.
Uh-huh. Yep. To Lori.
Yeah. So this guy's not already showing a really good track record, is he?
No. But Ethel has no money, and it sounds like a legitimate, helpful thing to do, so she accepts it and lets her daughters clean his house. And at this point, she had no reason to doubt the cancer diagnosis. I mean, most people don't make that kind of stuff up.
Right.
But months passed, and David didn't die or get any sicker. He still complained of pain and rectal bleeding, but it looked as if he wasn't going to die anytime soon. And he was very good to the Bailey family. In their cupboards, if they had no food, he brought them McDonald's or pizza, and he would always bring enough for the entire family. So this is a big deal to someone who's poor and living on food stamps.
Yeah, and of course it's a highly nutritious meal.
Well,
I guess it'll
fill you up. Who cares at that point if you're starving?
Yeah.
And someone brings pizza or McDonald's, you're thrilled, especially if you're a child. And a mother who can't feed her kids, can you imagine the position she's in?
Can't.
And this guy seems nice and brings all this food for her kids. Of course you're going to be happy about that.
Exactly.
Now, Linda and her siblings really idolized him. He was like Santa Claus or something.
Oh, sure.
One day he announced that a miracle had occurred and his cancer was gone now.
Oh, praise the Lord.
The doctors were cautious, he said, but it looked like he might be around for a while, and the whole Bailey family was relieved because he was, you know, yeah. their Daddy Warbucks.
Now he can keep buying us food and stuff.
Right.
So Linda gets to be around 14. She goes to see her Aunt Mary, and she asks Aunt Mary about birth control. So Mary, of course, tried to dissuade Linda, because she's only 14 after all, but she finally told her to go to Planned Parenthood. Now, when her mom, Ethel, learned about the birth control, she was very upset. And she and Linda argued, and Linda moved in with her Aunt Mary. And she lived with her aunt and uncle for about 2 years, and then she decides to marry David, because by this time, he's gotten out of his second marriage to Lori.
Yes.
And she's going to marry him.
Right. And, okay. you know, he's already been fooling around with her. We'll find out.
He has been.
He is a child molester. Now, Ethel Bailey reluctantly gave her consent for the marriage. But that didn't last either. Linda lived with David for a month and 24 days. And David would claim the marriage didn't work because of Linda's immaturity. Well, I wonder why she would be immature.
Well, let's see. At this point, she's 16 or so?
Right.
Oh, let me think.
Maybe you shouldn't be marrying 16-year-olds.
Maybe because she's 16, she's immature?
Never dated or anything.
You think?
So he divorced Linda, and she moved back with her mom, and her mom was relieved at that point and thought, oh, good, like they dodged a bad thing there. But just months later, David remarried someone else. This was his new wife, Cindy, and that marriage only lasted for 7 months. Now, his complaint there was that although Cindy was absolutely beautiful, she had a limited intellectual capacity. While they had a steamy sex life, he said, they had nothing else in common. Now, also of note was that Cindy had 2 children who David wasn't interested in at all. So he returned to Linda, showering her with gifts and promises. So Linda moved back in with David, and that was just weeks after Cindy had moved out. Her family tried to talk her out of it because they no longer liked or trusted him. They were starting to see what he was really about.
So this guy's what, in his 20s?
Yes.
Let me just count. He's had Brenda, Lori, Linda, and...
Cindy.
Who's the last one? Cindy. So
now he's got Linda again.
And now Linda's back again.
So this is number five.
This is a good track record so far.
Right. Plus, he was dating Linda's older sister at one point.
Right. And as we find out, he had eyes on Linda's younger sister.
Right. Yes. So she's in love with him, and her family's trying to talk her out of it, but that kind of circumstance, you really can't talk someone out of it.
No, you can't.
And I'm sure the money was a big pull, because they're poor people, and he had stuff to give.
Yeah, and it's kind of an easy choice. I mean, you might loathe the guy, but look what he's done for you.
Right. But they didn't loathe him, that's the thing.
Well, the mother did.
Well, yes, the mother's not cool with it, but she did give consent.
Yeah.
Now, Linda stayed close to her family, even while she was with David. So Linda's mother said she really didn't like him, but she didn't want to lose her daughter, which is smart because if she starts talking against David and tries to pull her away, she's just going to lose Linda.
Yeah, that's just going to be counterproductive.
Right. Now, David was kind of an odd guy. He had no male friends, and he surrounded himself with women who were younger, and you could even say children, and who he could control. He had his own isolated world where no one questioned him or doubted him.
Yeah, and David turns out to be in the right place at the right time. Because in the early 80s, computer records were very vulnerable. Now, he was on the ground floor of a news service to protect these computer records. So David worked as a subcontractor for a company called Random Acts Incorporated. And this company had a system for retrieving most of the lost data.
Well, 40% to 60%.
Yeah, okay.
So at least almost, around half.
Almost most. He refined and improved their techniques into what he called the process. And by doing this, he could consistently retrieve about 70% of lost data.
Which doesn't seem like a huge difference, but it is.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah. So David allowed Linda to have knowledge of the process, and she worked with him. By 1984, he was earning over $170,000 a year.
That's a lot of money, especially in the 80s.
Yeah.
A lot of money.
And this is a school dropout. He got a GED.
Yeah.
And he's never gone to college or anything.
Right.
So, pretty good.
That's very impressive, or lucky. So, Patty had only been 8 years old when she entered David's life.
Now, Patty is Linda's younger sister.
Right. He was 24, and she always looked up to him, and she loved to listen to him talk. Apparently, he had this kind of deep, like, radio announcer type of voice.
A deep voice.
Yes. So she had a little girl's dream that someday David would take her away and marry her. When Linda married David the second time, Linda told Patty she could live with them. So from the time that Patty was 12, she lived with David and her sister. They were part of the family. And she followed him like a cult member. She obviously had a crush on him, but her sister thought she'd outgrow it when she began to date boys her own age. Patty and Cinnamon were pretty close together in age, and they were friends. You know, they argued, but two teenagers, they got along and did some stuff together.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like sisters.
Sure. You know? Right.
They liked each other, and they'd fight and do what sisters do.
Exactly.
So Cinnamon was a more independent person than either Patty or Linda. Whenever she disobeyed her father, he would spank her in her underwear in front of the other girls.
Very humiliating.
Very. And Cinnamon, though, moved back and forth between her two parents, and she was kind of a lost child. Her mother had been the disciplinarian, well, David was the quote-unquote fun parent. And she loved her father beyond what would be considered normal and worried about his health and well-being even more than her own. So she's kind of obsessed on making sure that her father is in the best possible shape.
Well, you know, he set people up that way because he's always kind of hanging over their head, oh, I might not be around that long. And
right.
Yeah, he's very manipulative.
You got to take care of me.
Right. So the state of his health is really an odd issue with him. He talked constantly of his illnesses. He chain-smoked, he ate nothing but junk food, and he didn't exercise.
Chain-smoked is an understatement. He smoked 3 to 4 packs a day.
Right, so constantly smoking.
That is a huge amount.
Yes. He was on multiple medications for everything from asthma to anxiety, and he spent money on his family, and they did fun things together. And that's why they really liked to be around him. They rented movies and played games. Sometimes they took day trips to the desert, but he wasn't athletic at all. The most physical thing they did do was go out shooting at beer cans and targets. So there were several guns in the house, both rifles and handguns. And although his income was growing, he used insurance companies to make money and to update some of his possessions.
Yeah, so he's running a little scam here.
Several.
Okay. More than one.
Yeah.
So he collected on over 12 car accidents. And that was 12. I think what I read, he'd been involved in at least 17 total.
Yeah, 12's probably a modest estimate.
He had sued a supermarket by claiming that he tripped over an extension cord. There's an old shed on his property filled with furniture and building supplies that he didn't want anymore. So he rented a bulldozer and tried to get his brother-in-law, Alan, to crush the shed so he could collect insurance money on all the contents. But Alan backed out because he realized that it would be difficult to convince anyone that he by accident ran into a shed with a bulldozer. That's probably true.
Well, and then accidentally kept going until the contents are smashed.
Yeah, I didn't mean to do that.
That would be very strange.
It would be.
So in 1984, an elderly next-door neighbor lost control of her car, and her car leapt across the small strip of yard between their two houses, and it hit the brown house just below a bedroom window. David saw this as a chance to get a new computer. So what he did was, he moved his desk into that bedroom, right where the car hit, and said the computer was knocked to the floor. So the neighbor's insurance paid for a new IBM computer, which in this time period was very expensive. Computers weren't in everyone's house.
No, we're talking early to mid-80s.
Yes.
Big time money.
Computer that he did his work on.
Yeah.
But the thing is, he didn't need to do this. He's already making, he's like in the top, what, 95% of people.
Yeah,
he's making a ton of money.
He's making great money. So Linda gets pregnant, and things begin to change in the Brown household. Linda was fat and uncomfortable in that Southern California summer.
Well, and the thing to think about here is that this is not what he wanted. He wanted trim little teenage girls,
right.
As gross as that is.
I know.
Yeah.
So you can't be fat and pregnant.
So as soon as she becomes pregnant, he kind of loses interest.
Yeah. And at this time, Patty's now 16, and she's looking pretty good, running around in her halter tops, her short shorts, her her bikini.
Yeah.
So
gross.
Linda feels like David's eyes are starting to wander a little bit.
I think she's right.
And she's getting jealous because Patty's not a little kid anymore, but she still had an obvious crush on David.
Yeah, David could do no wrong in Patty's eyes.
Nope, couldn't.
No.
And Linda noticed that Patty was getting to be more seductive in her actions, and she's just recognizing that she had done the same thing at Patty's age.
Yeah, so it's kind of the same thing that happened with her.
Yeah.
Now, David stopped spending as much time with Linda then, and he began taking Patty with him when he went out of the house. Ethel wanted Patty to move back home. But when Linda brought it up, David refused to ask Patty to leave the house. So we can see what's going on here. We got some trouble.
We got some trouble here, don't we?
Yes.
It's brewing.
It's brewing for sure. And then after Crystal's born in July, everyone seems happy. There's like a honeymoon period. And Linda set aside her jealousy and seemed close to Patty as they took care of the baby together for a short time.
For a short time. So meanwhile, Brenda, who remember was David's first wife, she's offering baby care advice to Linda. And one day, Brenda called the house to get Cinnamon's birth certificate, which David had in his safe. Linda said she'd look into it, but then she said, "I'm scared, but I'll do it." So what's that?
That's...
Why is she scared?
Because David's a scary guy.
So David comes home while Linda's in the safe, and Brenda heard Linda go into a full-blown panic attack. She's terrified of what David would do if he found she'd gone into the safe. And Brenda herself knew what it was like to be afraid of David, right?
Well, yeah, he tortured her for years.
Yeah.
Or tormented her.
So this seems to be a good time to talk about underwear.
It is. Oh, okay, I'm game.
Yeah, guys want underwear to look good and to be comfortable.
Well, you know, putting on good underwear in the morning helps me feel confident, powerful, even kind of sexy. Like, hey, I can take on the world.
Yeah, and you can feel good about MeUndies in many ways. First of all, they're made from a sustainably sourced, naturally soft fabric that is 3 times softer than cotton.
Yeah, so they're breathable, and they come in tons of different colors, patterns, and styles. They have thongs, bikinis, and even boy shorts for us ladies.
Yeah, and for the guys, they have just the right support and don't ever feel too tight.
That's important, especially if you want to have babies.
That's right.
Just go to MeUndies.com/brewery to get 20% off, free shipping, and 100% satisfaction guaranteed on the best, softest underwear you'll ever own. That's MeUndies.com/brewery. Now, this is a limited time offer, so what are you waiting for? Start wearing the best underwear of your life. It changed my life, so let MeUndies change yours. Now they have the Halloween collection with skulls, candy corn, and even glow-in-the-dark designs.
So go to MeUndies.com/brewery, B-R-E-W-E-R-Y, right now.
Going to the salon can be a luxury, but it can also be expensive and time-consuming. I've been getting my hair colored at the salon for years, and I honestly never thought I would color my hair at home again. Those drugstore boxes were always a hit or miss. And back in college, you can see pictures of me with green, purple, and orange hair, and that wasn't on purpose. But that was before Madison Reed entered my life. Madison Reed is revolutionizing the way we color our hair with the ultimate hair color hack, the quality of salon color with the convenience and affordability I can really get behind. So join me in getting multidimensional European hair color delivered to your home on your schedule for under $25. Find your perfect shade at madison-reed.com. Madison Reed is honoring True Crime Brewery listeners with 10% off and free shipping on your first color kit by using promo code BREWERY. That's madison-reed.com and use the promo code BREWERY to get 10% off plus free shipping.
And one more. Let's talk about HelloFresh. So HelloFresh makes cooking fun, so we enjoy the whole experience of a meal, not just the final plate. Now, just last night, we had harissa sweet potato pita pockets. And this is one of those recipes where you'd think these ingredients just don't go together. But they do. So in this recipe, we had fresh pita bread filled with roasted slices of sweet potato and slices of ripe avocado. Very light, yet filling. And we had it with an herby cucumber salad that had pine nuts.
Yeah, HelloFresh really makes cooking fun. They are a farm-to-box company making fresh ingredients available to all of us in just the right amounts. I also like to call them a couch to kitchen company because they get me off the couch and into the kitchen to help Dick make dinner. In 6 easy steps, for about 30 minutes, we cook, chop, and spice, usually sharing a fine beer.
HelloFresh offers a classic box, a veggie box, or a family box. And you can order 3, 4, or 5 meals per week with fresh new recipes each time. So for $30 off your first week of HelloFresh, visit HelloFresh.com and enter promo code TCB30.
So in January of 1985, Cinnamon caught David and Patty kissing in the clothing section of Walmart.
I'm sorry. That picture just
tickles
me. That's
not a romantic idea to you?
No.
It was a passionate kiss, and Cinnamon...
That's even better. It wasn't just a kiss. Okay, I'm good.
You're good. All right. Now, this was a passionate kiss, and Cinnamon froze in disbelief when she saw it. When David saw Cinnamon looking, she ran away, and he chased her through the store and told her it was an accident.
Yeah, our lips just bumped into each other's.
Right. So she didn't tell Linda, out of fear that David would banish her from the house, but she felt really bad for Linda. Cinnamon was confused by what she saw. Why would her dad be kissing a girl that's almost as young as she was? Patty was still in high school. Patty had never kissed a boy her own age or even gone out on a date before. And David has just had a baby with Linda.
Well, you wouldn't expect that behavior, would you?
No, especially not in a Walmart.
No, don't get me started.
That just kills you, all right.
So the morning after Linda's murder, Cinnamon was held at the Garden Grove Police Headquarters. Paramedics examined her. She was found to be in stable condition, but they really had no idea if that would change. So Cinnamon admitted to taking 3 bottles of pills, one of which was Darvocet, at around 2 in the morning. Cinnamon kept asking if her dad was okay. Now, police had found empty medicine bottles in the Browns' laundry room, and they brought them to show the paramedics.
Now, at 8 a.m., Cinnamon was interviewed by a detective. She admitted to shooting Linda. She said she had shot the gun once in Patty's room and twice at Linda. She said that Linda was tired of her and wanted to get rid of her. She also said that she had found the gun in her father's drawer, and she knew how to shoot it. By 9:30, Cinnamon was becoming unresponsive.
She's got a shitload of pills in
her. I know. I'm just shocked they didn't take her to the hospital sooner.
Well, we're going to find out that everything she said got disallowed.
Right.
Because of her state.
At that point, yes.
Yeah.
Now, the interview was stopped, and then she was finally taken to the hospital.
Well, good.
But I think I
had a bunch of criticism for this.
They shouldn't have taken her for an interview.
No.
Not to mention that she's only 14, and she should have had a parent or a lawyer with her.
Don't even get me started on that. But she was ill.
She was in danger of dying. She's overdosed.
She had.
Just because
they're continuing to question her.
Well, yeah, they think just because her vital signs are stable that she's not going to... She could have died.
She easily could have.
Because she hadn't had her stomach pumped.
Not till she got to the hospital.
Right. So when police talked to Brenda, she said that David and Patty had stopped by her house that morning. So that was a shocker. David had told her that Cinnamon had killed Linda and overdosed. He told her not to tell detectives that she was a good, well-behaved girl.
And yeah, Brenda, he wanted her to tell detectives that she was a pain in the ass, basically.
Yeah. Now, Brenda said she was surprised to see David and Patty so calm that day. I don't understand why Brenda wasn't at the hospital immediately, why she wasn't called as a parent and wasn't down there with her daughter.
Well, they called the parent she resided with. Not called, but David
was
aware.
Yes. But nobody was with her in the interrogation room or at the hospital. No parent.
Right. Well, David should have said, talk to my ex-wife, her mother.
Well, but that's not what he wanted.
I know.
Right. So, actually, Cinnamon was a pretty normal teenager. Brenda insisted she was and said that she got along well with Linda. Cinnamon had told Brenda that David and Linda weren't getting along. Linda was afraid that David might leave her for Patty. So this shocked the detective to hear this. So what Brenda had heard from her daughter Cinnamon, just to clarify this because all these names, was that Patty and David were kind of together and that Linda was afraid that David would leave her for her younger sister Patty. So this is a lot for the police to absorb, and they just think maybe this is Cinnamon's overactive imagination.
Exactly.
Because Patty's only 17,
she is. But, you know, David likes those young ones.
Well, that's what Brenda said. She right. said that he really liked young girls. She said that Linda was actually younger than that when he started with her.
Yeah. I mean, Brenda's lived through the same thing.
Right. Although he was more Brenda's age.
Yeah.
Right.
So on March 20th, Cinnamon was evaluated by a psychiatrist. She denied that she wanted to kill Linda. That was thought to be odd because she admitted to shooting her twice. Now, Cinnamon's biggest concern was whether or not her father would still love her. That's kind of weird.
Sad. It's very sad.
So she was too oriented to be psychotic, and she's too regretful to have an antisocial personality. So she ended up being diagnosed with severe clinical depression. By July, though, she claimed to not remember anything from the night of the murder. And at that point, she was diagnosed with psychogenic amnesia, which was something that is originating in the mind, but not from anything physical. So right. it's not like a head trauma type of case.
Right. Now, during the spring and summer of 1985, the Brown house was falling apart.
Understandably, right? His wife is dead. His daughter's accused of murdering the wife.
Mm-hmm.
What a mess. He's got a newborn, or not a newborn, but a young infant.
Well, yeah, and Linda was the one who'd been taking care of the baby in the house and everything, and now she's gone.
Yeah.
So David's parents moved in to help with the baby in the household, and Patty had taken over for Linda. She was actually wearing Linda's clothing, and she went around and replaced Linda's framed photos with pictures of her.
And I read that, and I said, this is extremely weird.
Isn't this
sick? She's pulling her sister's pictures out of framed photos and replacing them with her pictures.
Well, she's just like the new and improved Linda.
Yeah.
It's so bizarre.
It is. Totally.
I wonder if he didn't get caught, if he would have moved on down to the next Bailey daughter. I don't know how old she was.
Well, I think he either would have done that or he would have moved on to someone else.
Right.
But I don't think he would have been satisfied to remain with Patty.
No. Now, Patty seemed sweet and genuinely grief-stricken, despite gossip and assumptions by people who knew the family. But her behavior was very odd, but there was no evidence either that she was involved in Linda's murder.
Yeah, now, as we said before, Cinnamon's confession was thrown out because she'd been on medications. Well, she had overdosed on medications.
Right, right.
So there wasn't, at this time then, no physical evidence, no eyewitnesses, and no confession when she did go on trial. But police looked through Cinnamon's medical records, and they ended up finding a confession that had been written in the notes of a medical student who had taken care of Cinnamon. So that saves the case.
Right.
They've got a confession.
Right.
Even though the first one got thrown out, they had a second one.
Uh-huh. Now, Cinnamon was convicted of premeditated first-degree murder. Brenda was in the courtroom, but David Brown missed out on most of the trial. He had a doctor's note that he needed to remain in bed and couldn't be there. Cinnamon was sentenced to 27 years to life in prison, and she was committed to a juvenile detention center, which is good because it wasn't as bad as a prison would have been.
Right. So, and do you think he really needed to be bedridden?
No.
David?
I think he was used to getting doctors to write him prescriptions and
yeah.
notes and things. Absolutely.
So it should be all neatly tied up. We've got a child who was tried and convicted and sentenced.
Yeah, so but detectives have
it should
some,
be over.
Some detectives have some doubts about this.
Ah, obviously. So the detectives felt there was more to this Linda Brown murder than what had come out during the trial.
Yeah, David Brown was officially a law-abiding citizen, but something seemed to be going on beneath the surface. Everyone in the Brown and Bailey families had relied on David for their jobs and for their money. Now he was being treated for insomnia, depression, kidney problems, liver disease, high blood pressure, colitis, allergies, and nerves. He had also been in 17 automobile accidents. So you're right, that's what you said.
Yeah, I remembered that.
Yeah. So insurance claims had enabled him to upgrade his damaged vehicles. Now he smoked over 3 packs of cigarettes a day, like you said. And he loved to speak openly with people about his sexual exploits. And since they're with these younger girls, it really creeps people out.
This guy's a mess.
He's really fixated on teenage girls and what he does with them. It's
yeah.
super gross.
Creepy?
Very creepy.
What else can we say for an adjective?
Criminal.
Criminal is yeah. easy. So in November of 1985, this is 2-3 months after the killing, David was driving with Patty when their car was hit from behind. This accident was just a bump, with the other driver only going about 10 miles per hour. But David collected $12,500 for his own medical expenses and $10,500 for Patty's from his own insurance company. And then he also collected $38,000 from the other driver's insurance company. That's just criminal.
It is.
I mean, not even speaking about what a piece of shit David is.
Uh-huh.
How do insurance companies cough up that money? Don't they investigate these things?
Well, I mean, how much time do they have to investigate this? That's a small claim to them in the big picture.
Yeah, I know it is, but still. That's why rates go up all the time.
I know. Well, in checking public records, detectives found that within 3 weeks of Cinnamon's murder conviction, David went out and paid in full for a $330,000 house in Anaheim Hills. David's parents lived in the house with David, Patty, and baby Crystal. David's finances had improved significantly since Linda was murdered, and one suspicious detective named Jay Newell watched David and followed him after this as much as he could. He wanted to know what David was really up to.
And he's up to stuff.
So thankfully, this detective decided to follow up.
Yeah, when reading the book, I was impressed by how the detectives just didn't let it rest. And they could have. I mean, they could have let things go. They had a conviction and a sentencing. Case closed.
They could have.
But they felt something wasn't right.
And it's good he did that. Because
they kept investigating.
Think someone else could have ended up dead if he hadn't.
That's for sure.
So Jay Newell knew more about David's current lifestyle than Cinnamon did. David visited her occasionally, and they were quick visits, but he did keep money in her commissary account for her. She lived in a cottage for girls between 14 and 18 years old, so she had her own little room with pink curtains to cover the bars on her window. And she was cooperative with the prison officials, but she continued to deny any memory of the night of the murder. So in the summer of 1986, Patty and David got married, and Patty was really happy to become David's sixth wife.
For some reason.
Now, she begged David to let her tell their families that they were married, but he was adamant that it had to be a secret.
I can see that.
Well, yes.
Right?
Now, Cinnamon had seen them kiss that long time ago, and if she found out they were married, she might talk, he was afraid. Now, Cinnamon, in the meantime, was denied parole because she repeatedly refused psychological treatment, and she refused to talk about the crime.
Well, yeah, I mean, again, you're still early into the sentencing, but still, she's not cooperating.
No, she's protecting her father is what she's doing.
Right. So in January of 1987, the detective Jay Newell went to speak with Arthur Brown, who was David's father. He had been to visit Cinnamon. He's worried about her. But he was clearly afraid to say too much, but he had overheard Patty and David telling Cinnamon that Linda was plotting to kill David. Well, so that's some new information, huh?
Right.
And this is the first time Newell heard anything to support his suspicions that Patty and David were involved. So while the two men were talking outside of the Brown home, David came home. And as he pulled into the driveway, his father, Arthur, looked panicked. Newell said he'd pretend to be a real estate agent. And when David walked up, Newell shook his hand and had a short conversation about real estate. But Arthur turned out to be too weak to continue the charade. He talked that evening to David and said that Newell was a detective. So David's furious. He burns his marriage certificates, apparently unaware that all of this was on file, could easily be replaced. So
how could he not know that? He's supposed to be a smart man.
He's a computer nerd.
Yeah.
Right? He should know that.
He should know that. But he was becoming really paranoid. He gave Patty a beeper and insisted that she call immediately whenever he paged her. He called her at the house often whenever he left the house. In February 1987, Patty told David that she was pregnant, and he immediately told her to go have an abortion. But for once, Patty stood up to him, and she refused to do that because she had purposely gotten pregnant. She wanted a baby.
Well, sure.
Now, Patty had a baby girl that September and named her Heather. But David denied that he was the father. He told his parents...
Jesus.
He told his parents that Patty had gotten herself pregnant by some guy named Doug. It would have been impossible, though, for Patty to have been seeing anyone. But nobody had the guts to confront David about this.
Yeah, but, I mean, Patty's on call 24 hours a day. I mean,
Yeah.
He knows.
She has no freedom.
Every place she is.
And plus, this really hurt her because she loves him and he's denying their baby. She became really depressed and she made some suicide attempts at this point. Cutting on her arms was really a sad time. Plus, she probably had some guilt regarding her sister's murder.
Think so?
I would think so.
Yeah, me too.
Now, David applied with numerous insurance agents for several hundred thousands of dollars in life insurance for Heather. That's scary.
Yes, I'm worried because he's denied paternity.
I just really
feel... And he's going to take out life insurance on her?
I really feel like he would have killed someone else.
Yeah.
He was already thinking about it.
Yeah, he's just trying to figure out the way to do it.
Right. Now, he was turned down, thankfully, by these insurance agents because they couldn't justify having that much insurance on a newborn infant. Patty and Manuela weren't getting along, so David went and bought another new house with room to have a guest house built for his parents. He's got some money, too.
He's got plenty of cash rolling in.
He does.
He's working hard at his computer business.
Well, I don't know if he's working hard, but it's bringing in money.
Making money.
Yeah.
Cinnamon's still locked up in 1988 when she turns 18. And she didn't know that Patty and David were married, and she didn't know that Patty had had a baby. She heard from Arthur Brown, her grandfather, Patty had a baby from some guy named Doug. So Dad's passing along the information from his son.
Yes.
I didn't father that child.
Right.
Now, Cinnamon's suspicious because she thinks that her father was the baby's father.
Of course she does.
David's visits become less frequent. Whenever she called the house, she was always told that he was out at the store or the movies, so she's not in contact much with him anymore.
No. So Cinnamon's starting to have her own thoughts here as she gets older. So Jay Newell's astounded when she calls him. She wants to talk to him. But her first question was if her father would be listening in on the calls. And when she was assured that he wouldn't be, she spoke with him. She told him that she was involved, but she was told by David that Linda was planning on killing him. He said that they would have to come up with a way to get rid of her, or David would have to leave town. Now, Cinnamon didn't want her father to leave her. He said that she would have to help him then. So he started taking Cinnamon and Patty on these long drives where they would talk about ways to get rid of Linda. After the murder, her father had first told her to confess. Then he had told her not to remember anything and to not say anything to the police. Now, Patty never visited her. Cinnamon brought up Patty's baby, saying that she knew it was her father's baby, to Newell, while she's speaking to Newell.
Okay, yeah, she didn't raise the baby.
No.
Okay.
She brought up the subject.
She brought up the subject of the baby.
Right. Because the baby seemed to be the final insult that broke Cinnamon's loyalty to her father.
It sounds like, doesn't it?
Yeah. But she's also afraid of him, too.
Well, sure. Now, however, the murder had been solved, as we said. Case was closed. We've got a confession, a sentencing. Everything's good. Wouldn't be easy to reopen the case, would it?
No, it's not easy to do that.
So Jay Newell worked with the prosecutor, Jeff Robinson, and they got permission to pursue the case from the district attorney. In August of 1988, detectives went to speak with Cinnamon in person, and she told them that she was in the living room when Patty came out and said she had overheard a phone conversation between Linda and her brother, Alan, and it sounded like they were plotting to kill David. Cinnamon had left, but Patty insisted she was serious. Now, this is just a short time before the murder.
A few months.
So later, riding in the car with Patty and David, Patty had repeated that Linda wanted to kill David, which we've heard this before. She said she knew Linda and they had to get rid of her before she killed David. And David said he would just move away. But Cinnamon and Patty didn't want him to go.
So that's when he said that she would have to help them to get rid of Linda.
Yeah, he's got the way out because nobody wants David to leave.
Right.
Right?
And then it's like getting more and more urgent that they need to kill her.
Right.
So he's really piling that on. And then he also said, do you love me, Cinnamon? I want to make sure that you love me enough to do anything for me.
Yeah, this is the horrible stuff.
It is.
How can you do that to a kid? You know, if you love me enough, you'll do exactly what I want.
Right. He told her he didn't have the stomach to kill Linda himself, so he would need her help. If you love me, you will trust me, he said. So the topic of killing Linda became an almost daily thing, And so it almost seemed like a normal thing, you know, and it's talked about all the time.
Yeah.
And you're 14.
Just, it's everything we're talking about.
They're making it seem like it's almost a normal thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
So on the day before Linda's death, the family had played cards, and then David's parents had gone home after that. That night, David woke up Patty and Cinnamon. He said it had to be done that night, and he told Cinnamon to take the pills and had her get the suicide note that he'd had her write a few days earlier. She didn't admit at this point that she had done the shooting, but she would admit that later. She agreed to wear a wire and told David he needed to come and speak with her. When David came to visit, Cinnamon asked him questions about the night of the crime.
Yeah, now he's pretty clever, though. So he denies any part in the murder. But he offered to help her turn on Patty so that Patty could go to prison and Cinnamon could come home.
Well, because now he's done with Patty. Patty's had a baby.
Yeah, he's ready to move on.
Right.
So, but he also denies again that Heather was his baby.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that Patty had moved out of the house.
Which wasn't true.
No.
No. So there had been 4 insurance policies, it turns out, on Linda Brown's life at the time of her murder. As a housewife with no income of her own, she wouldn't have been eligible for this large policy. So David got around that by taking out 4 smaller policies. And they were all taken out in the year before her death. In all, he collected $843,000. If Cinnamon had also died that night, he would have collected on her as well.
Right, and there's a good possibility she could have.
I think that's what he wanted.
Seriously overdosed. And yeah, I think that was his plan.
Yeah. In September 1988, David and Patty were arrested. And in the police car, when the video recorder was running, David kept saying to Patty, "Now who is Heather's father anyway?" So this was clearly for the benefit of the police. This was really gross. But in denying Heather, who Patty loved more than anyone, he was making a big mistake because he's pissing her off now.
Yeah, she's going to turn on him.
She would have done anything for David until Heather was born, but now she has someone else she loves, and he's refusing to accept the child, so her devotion to him is really beginning to fray.
Definitely. So David's interviewed by Detective Jay Newell. David seemed calm. He talked about his poor health. He said he remembered hardly anything of the night of Linda's murder, and he said she is the love of his life.
It's really creepy. David said that he and Linda had sex that night.
Well, he has sex all the time anyway. According to him.
And he went on to describe their quirky sex life and how she would drive him crazy with her hands. He said he had a climax with her every night. They liked to keep their sex life fun, he said, and interesting. So it's a really odd conversation to have with the police about your dead wife.
Isn't it?
And the whole time he's chain smoking, he's talking on and on. It's a 3-hour interview, but it really helped police build a case against him.
Meanwhile, Patty's being interviewed in another room. And her story is that David was like a father to her, and they did not have a sexual relationship.
But they played tapes for her of David saying that he was afraid of her, and that she was a drug addict. But still she defended him, so she hasn't turned on him yet.
Not yet. Cinnamon soon confessed to Jay Newell that she had been the one to pull the trigger of the gun that killed Linda. She apologized for lying. Under the law, it really didn't matter who had pulled the trigger, because most of what she told him confirmed what she had said before, but there were new details. So David had told her she needed to shoot herself to look like she was trying to kill herself after she killed Linda. This is new.
Right.
He told her that after Linda was shot, she should shoot herself in the head with the same gun, just so it would nick her head. Right.
Yeah.
So Cinnamon's afraid to do this, so he just told her to take the bottles of pills. He gave her over 80 pills and a glass of water. David left the house. Patty handed Cinnamon the gun. She told Cinnamon to fire at Linda in the master bedroom. So Cinnamon goes into the master bedroom, shoots Linda. The pillow she used to muffle the shot got stuck to the gun. So Cinnamon ran back to Patty's room.
So this is scary, this whole thing.
This is, isn't it?
Yeah, Patty's holding the baby, as David had told her to do, and Patty and Cinnamon are struggling between them to free the pillow from the gun.
Yeah, and the gun goes off. So fortunately, it missed the baby.
Yeah, it's only luck that saved that baby.
And they hear Linda moaning in the other room, so Cinnamon goes back into Linda's room, shoots her again. She drops the gun and takes a suicide note to the doghouse with her.
Right, because she's already taken the pills. Now, Cinnamon was asked about her father telling her to shoot herself, because it's clear to them that David had wanted her to die too.
I mean, you're telling your kid to shoot herself in the head, but just at an angle so it's a glancing blow?
Yeah.
Come on.
I know.
He wanted her dead too.
But at that point, she's still in denial about it. She just can't accept that her father would want her dead.
It's inconceivable. So David Brown wrote letters to Patty proclaiming his love for her.
Now he's trying to save his ass.
Yeah. He added articles on marital fidelity from the Catholic Digest.
That's helpful.
That's what I was snickering about. Patty received letters from David and Doug, saying that he knew how much Doug loved her. Doug, he accepted Heather, saying that he loved her and Heather more than anything else. So he's writing letters under his name and Doug's name.
Right.
The fictitious Doug.
So Doug is him.
Right.
That's his way of telling her.
Yeah, it's not.
He can't say it's his baby.
Right. It's Doug's baby.
But nobody's falling for this.
Of course not.
Now, Patty ignored his letters and began to speak with prosecutors anyway. She was really ready now to expose David for the manipulator that he was. She told them she'd been living with David and Linda for 5 years. The situation in the home seemed pretty normal at first, but then David began to suggest that Linda was changing and wasn't much fun anymore. He once said that if a gun went off accidentally and Linda was shot, Patty would be able to take her place.
See, he's laying the groundwork, isn't he?
Yeah, early on.
Jesus.
He's got it planned out. He made a joke of it, but we know where he was headed with it.
We too.
Now, she wasn't taking him seriously until about 6 months before Linda died, she said. David had Patty go into Linda's room with a gun, and he wanted her to shoot Linda. She didn't do it, and she backed out. She said she felt obligated to participate to keep the family together, though. So she admitted to participating in the plan to kill Linda. Gradually, Patty did verify Cinnamon's latest confession. She said her reason for participating was that David had convinced her that Linda was going to tear them all apart. She had honestly believed that everything would be fine after Linda was killed. Now, because Cinnamon was only 14, he told her that she would never go to prison. So it would be good to have her do it.
Big mistake.
Right.
So Patty testifies in a preliminary hearing that she had loved David as a father until she was 11. And then those feelings became more complex. And David began to sexually molest her pretty much as soon as she moved in with him.
That's so sad.
Oh, God.
He ruined her life.
He did. So David assured her that most grown men help girls to grow up by teaching them about love.
Yeah, he encouraged her to give him oral sex and said that would help her become a woman. And he also fondled her chest and said that would help her develop breasts. At 15, she began having intercourse with him. And she loved her sister, but she said she had to admit she loved David more, and she was ashamed of that now. The only time she cried was when she was asked about Heather, though. David was Heather's father, she admitted, and she had never been with another man.
Yeah, not ever. So January of 1989, Patty's facing charges in juvie court because she's only 17 when Linda was killed.
Yeah, so David's in jail, held over for trial. But he had a lot of money at his disposal to get what he wanted while he was there. So he was bribing and bragging and kind of making his way up the ranks.
He's a mover.
Right. So by the time David had a date for his trial, he'd already put other plans in place. One of his new friends was Richard Steinhardt, who'd been picked up on Christmas Eve for a probation violation. He was this big guy with long black hair and lots of tattoos. He had black belts in 6 different martial arts, and he usually worked as a bodyguard or a bouncer. So he was befriended by David Brown in jail for his physical strength. He saw David as a ruthless person with no street smarts. Steinhardt listened to David Brown's stories and offered to help him take care of his problems before the trial even took place. Now, he convinced David that he had connections and that he could get things done. And they planned how they would get revenge, escape, and start new lives far away. Now, for this, David had offered him $300,000. But David wanted at least 3 people executed. He said he had $3 million buried in the desert. Jeff Robinson and Jane Newell were to be executed first, followed by Patty. But he really found it difficult to remain detached from David Brown because even though he's a criminal, he thinks David is real scum. So one day in the yard, Steinhardt confided in another prisoner, Irv Cully, how he really felt about David Brown. Now, Cully, he was an informant. And he said to Steinhardt he was glad that he felt that way because he'd just given them up to the police. So Cully had gone to the authorities and told them about David's plans. And David had offered Cully's girlfriend money to get herself arrested and placed in the jail with Patty. Then she could be a witness for David to place the entire murder plot on Patty, saying that Patty confessed to her while in jail. So
pretty
it's very
clever.
Twisted.
Yeah. So Steinhardt went on to speak with the police after that. And he told Jay Newell all the details of David's plan. So the best plan they came up with was to let David go on thinking that Steinhardt was his man so he wouldn't look for more help. And Steinhardt would have to wear a wire and talk to David. David would have to initiate the discussion about murders and escape. Newell arranged for Steinhardt to appear to be released, but he was actually just transferred to another jail.
Yeah, so he was wired on the day he was getting out, and the two men, David and Steinhardt, spoke in code. They called Patty Bailey, the girl upstairs, and she was to be killed as soon as possible after Newell and Robinson were killed, so police wouldn't be able to get to her. So if any cops had to be killed in the course of his escape, David said he was okay with that. He actually said, "I think I'm more important than they are." What a scumbag.
So Steinhardt pretends to be free, and he has a phone that was wired for all calls to be recorded. So in order for Steinhardt to convince David that he had burned down David's house for the insurance money, that was part of the plan, right?
Yeah.
Newell surveyed the area to get the details right. So Steinhardt likes this job as a free man. He often pretended to be coming home from a hot date or getting a cold beer from the fridge. He knew that David missed pizza, so Steinhardt loved to pretend he had ordered pizza. So under heavy surveillance, Steinhardt was taken out to pick up two guns and $1,700 in expense money. David's older brother, Tom, had made the drop after David told him he had hired Steinhardt as a bodyguard. So he's not telling Tom, his brother, that he's going to kill people.
No, Tom
didn't
know.
Here's what we need.
Right. So Robinson and Newell were to be shot in the back of the head, and Stuhart assured David that he had put a woman into Patty's jail to kill her as soon as the prosecutor and detective had been executed. Now, he told David that Patty would be knifed, and David's reply was really kind of excited and happy. All right, that's good, he said. What a scumbag.
Jesus. So Steinhardt is not a killer. I mean, he might be a lot of things, but he's not a killer.
He's kind of a ruffian, small-time crook.
Yeah. So he's released under the California Protected Witness Program. And there had to be two women to take care of Patty. David believed there was one to testify, and Patty had confessed to the murder on her own. And there was one to kill Patty.
Right. So we need one to testify that she's the one that confessed.
Right.
And one to kill her so she can't argue that.
Yep.
So in February, David's brother Tom Brown delivered $10,000 to Steinhardt and a detective who was playing the part of the other killer. And it was recorded on hidden video cameras. Steinhardt got a phone in his motel room where collect calls could be recorded and accepted from David Brown. And Newell had to be sure that Steinhardt didn't disappear on him because he is still a criminal.
That's right.
But he didn't.
So these executions of the police detectives and Patty.
The detective and the prosecutor.
Right.
Yeah.
Not two detectives.
No.
Were scheduled for February 13th or 14th. Tom Brown was to deliver the final payment of $11,000 after David had been notified that the two men were dead. Then Steinhardt would begin getting passports for David and himself. On the 13th, David called. Steinhardt said, "Everything's done, it's cool. Everything going off easily." Tom Brown delivered the money to Steinhardt, and suddenly the parking lot was filled with police. Whoa.
So Tom had no idea what this was all about. Until they said, you know, you're under arrest for first-degree murder.
Yeah, Tom only thought the money was for protection from people who were threatening David and David's family. So he gets released after a few hours.
Yeah. Now, David learned the next day that Richard Steinhardt had actually set him up. He hadn't killed anybody. Jay Newell had video and audio of David soliciting three murders. The next day, he was charged with three counts of conspiracy to commit murder, three counts of solicitation to commit murder, solicitation to commit perjury, and a conspiracy to commit arson. So in May, Patty pled guilty to her sister's murder, and she was sentenced to the California Youth Authority until her 25th birthday. David Brown hired two of the top defense attorneys in Orange County, because he does have money.
He does.
And the prosecution spelled out the whole story for the jury on how David sexually molested and manipulated young women to kill his young wife for money, and so that he could be with the younger sister. Cinnamon testified about how her father had told her to shoot herself, and at the time, she hadn't realized that David wanted her to die that day. He told her to shoot herself and made her take the pills because he wanted her dead, not because it would give her an alibi, and she finally seemed to realize that.
Finally.
Yeah.
Took a while.
Well, she was a kid. It's her dad.
I can't imagine.
Yeah,
that's true.
Yeah.
So Patty and Cinnamon's memories of the night Linda was murdered supported each other's. The tapes of David soliciting the murders of the prosecutor, the detective, and Patty were just absolutely unbelievable.
Yes.
He had said he was more important than anyone who got in the way. And when he was told the executions were done, he sounded quite happy.
Right. Now, his defense attorneys had some big challenges in defending him.
I would think.
Their arguments were to throw out ideas and theories and just see what would stick. They urged the jury to look at the evidence and see that Patty and Cinnamon were the ones fully responsible for Linda's murder. They said that David Brown was a weak man who had been played by Richard Steinhardt. The attorney also attacked Cinnamon and Patty, calling them greedy, manipulating. You know, don't let them fool you as being innocent girls, because they're not. After all, they said David wasn't even there when Linda was killed. He described Patty as an 11-year-old who forced himself on David Brown. And as you can imagine, this did not go over well with the jurors.
I can imagine. In conservative Orange County, California.
Well, I think anybody would be horrified that you would say 11-year-old would seduce a 27-year-old man. That's ridiculous.
It's
disgusting.
Certainly is.
So the jury went to deliberate at 2:44 p.m. on June 13th. They were only to deliberate between 9 a.m. and 4:30 p.m., and they weren't sequestered. And it was on the afternoon of June 15th when the verdict came in.
So 2 days.
Yeah. So David looked pretty worried when he came in, and he was right. He was found guilty on all the charges. Now, when the judge spoke to him, he called him a scary person and a master manipulator. And with that said, David was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole.
I think that's fitting.
Yes. There was a call for the death penalty, but they took mercy on him.
Yeah. And Cinnamon was paroled in 1992 at age 21 after serving 8 years in the California Youth Authority facility.
So if you want to learn more about this case, there is this four-hour 1991 NBC miniseries, Love, Lies, and Murder, which was pretty good. And that's based on the two books about the case that we read. There's If You Really Loved Me by Anne Rule and A Killing in the Family by Stephen Singulair, Tim Hill, and Daniel Hill.
They were pretty good reads. This is just a tragic story.
It sure is. It's really sad. I just want to take a minute here to talk about our members-only episodes for Team Tigrabber members. We're doing a string of honeymoon murders / suspicious deaths right now. We just released Overboard, The Disappearance of George Smith, last week, and we hope to have a new episode out next week. There are 10 or so members-only episodes available now, so if you join now, you can download all of them and binge, plus you'll get new episodes every month. Now, joining us is easy. All you have to do is go to tigrabber.com and sign up with PayPal. You can also pledge support on Patreon and listen to these members-only episodes there as a patron. There's also another way for you to give us some support, and this way is absolutely free. The next time you shop Amazon, please go in through the link on tigrabber.com. Then Amazon will give us a tiny kickback from your purchases that you would have made anyway. They don't tell us what you bought or what you spent, and there are no changes to the prices. So it's just a great way to smoothly give us some support. If you have feedback for us, you can contact us at truecrimebrewery@tigrabber.com. On Twitter at Tigrabber Pods, also on Instagram, Tigrabber Podcasts. We also have a Facebook page, and there is a True Crime Brewery fan discussions page where anyone can join, and you can chat about any true crimes, episodes we've done, episodes you'd like us to do, talk about details of crimes, your own theories. There are a lot of true crime geeks there that love to talk about anything true crime, and especially anything True Crime Brewery. We're always happy to get reviews on iTunes. So if you'd like to give us a review, we'd love that. And if you enjoy the podcast, please let other people know. Spreading the word is really very helpful. And as always, thank you for your support in any way that you give it. Okay, well, let's go on to feedback.
Okay. I want to live with a cinnamon girl. I can be happy the rest of my life with a cinnamon girl. A dreamer of pictures, I run in the night. You see us together chasing the moonlight. My cinnamon. Welcome to Feedback.
All right.
You get to go first today, Jill.
Thank you. So the first letter I have is from Marie S., and it's an Australian suggestion. And she said, just love your podcasts. I know you are overwhelmed with requests and suggestions, but I thought I would share a couple of very interesting Australian cases that you might like to look at. They might go on the pending list for the quiet end of the bar. One case that has caught my inner suspicion switch is that of Phoebe Hansjuk, a beautiful but troubled young lady who died after entering and falling through a high-rise apartment garbage disposal system. There are many questions about this case and how she got into the garbage system. The coroner ruled it an accidental death. Questions have been asked about the fact that her boyfriend's family are prominent members of the judiciary system in Australia. I hope you have time to review this case. I feel for her family, who are still fighting for their daughter. Thank you again for making my housework and drives to work so much more entertaining. So yeah, this was quite a case. It's really horrific.
Yeah, I can't imagine diving down a garbage chute.
No. She was feet first. And I just can't see that as a suicide or an accident. I mean, how would you do that? So yeah, I'm going to look into it. Of course, we don't know much about it, but it seems like a really interesting case. And we've really had some great Australian cases that I've liked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to need people to send me Australian beers. I'm running out of them.
Okay. All right, so maybe Marie can do that.
We'll ask her.
Yeah, sounds good.
So I got one from Cliff, who's going to talk about huckleberries. He starts off by giving us some excessively laudatory compliments that I'm going to skip over.
Okay, but should we tell people what huckleberry refers to? Why he's still telling us about huckleberry?
Well, huckleberries, we talked about in one of our recent episodes as context of I'm your huckleberry, meaning I'm your guy.
Right.
I'm the man to do it.
In the Unfriended episode.
So Cliff says that he was always led to believe it was a Tom Sawyer reference, being that Huck was Tom's right-hand man. And Cliff says he believes it was also made famous as a movie quote by Doc Holliday in Tombstone.
Yeah, a few people have told me that.
So?
Yeah.
So yeah, I think the being your huckleberry means that you're the man.
Okay.
You're going to take care of things.
We still don't know what that was meant to be in the context of that case.
Well, we've discussed that, haven't
yeah.
we?
Yeah.
And we have a couple different opinions on it.
Right. But the consensus is that that's what it means. I'm your man.
I mean,
I'm the man for the job.
We agree that it means I'm your man. We just kind of disagreed about who was the author of that.
Right,
In the context of the case.
Okay. Fair enough. So I have a letter here from Amber about Stephen Stainer, which was a recommended case. Dear Dick and Jill, I just heard your latest episode and the feedback you received recommending covering the case of Stephen Stainer. I wanted to chime in with a twist that makes this case truly extraordinary to me. In 1999, about 28 years after Stephen was abducted, 19 years after he was returned, and 18 years after he died in a motorcycle wreck, his brother Carrie Stainer murdered 4 women over a period of several months. Carrie is currently on death row. This case raises a lot of questions for me. How much did the trauma of his brother's kidnapping and the very high profile he had as a result, a movie was made about Stephen, she says, contribute to the sick man Carrie became? Or were the Stainers just the unluckiest family in the world that their sons became a kidnapping victim and a serial killer? So I think that is an interesting aspect about it. We've gotten a few emails about this case, but I thought this kind of made a point of something interesting besides the general case.
It's more than just the general case.
Right.
Right?
It's the dynamics of a family, the psychology. Yeah. So that makes it...
So that's stuff we like to look at.
Yeah, that makes it even more fascinating.
So I think we're in there.
Okay.
Okay, I got a note from Donna with a suggestion. Have you looked into the case of Alvin Howard Neely Jr. and Judith Neely? They went on a killing spree in the 1980s or thereabouts, convicted of 2 murders and suspected of several more. They're suspected of killing a lady in a robbery in my hometown of Albany, Georgia. Alvin is dead now, but Judith is trying to get parole. She is given a death penalty, but later this is commuted to life in prison with possibility of parole. I've tried to get access to the case file for Janice Hare, one of the murder victims, but unfortunately it's believed they were destroyed in the flood of 94 that damaged many government buildings and destroyed many documents.
Yeah, it's surprising how much that kind of thing happens.
So the Neelys were each convicted of kidnappings and murders of Lisa Ann Milliken and Janice K. Chatham, and an attempted third murder. She was sentenced to death, but it was commuted to life imprisonment. And she's serving her sentence at a prison in Alabama. Her husband was serving a life sentence in Georgia, but he died.
Huh. Do we know how he died? Natural causes? Or?
We don't know.
Okay.
Or in the stuff I've read, I don't know.
Okay. So was this a robbery and murder thing that they were going on? Or?
No, it was mostly a murder spree.
Huh.
So yeah, there was a youth development center employee who was shot. And then a 13-year-old girl who was abducted and killed.
Wow.
And a couple who were engaged to be married who were abducted and shot and tortured and murdered. But one of them didn't die. And he was able to point to the Neelys as his assailants.
So okay.
That's how they got the conviction.
Okay.
So that sounds like a worthwhile thing.
Yeah, we'll look into that.
Let's think about that.
Okay. So I have a letter from L.H., and it's about the episode Unfriended, about the catfishing murders of Billie Jean Hayworth and Bill Payne. Thank God the baby was found safe, she says. They could have gone to the police if they really felt their daughter was in danger or any number of things besides murder. I agree. I think these are just bad people to do what they did, and I agree with her on that.
We both do.
Mm-hmm.
So here's a suggestion from Jessica. She says, I'm relatively new to the podcast, but I'm currently binging on all the episodes.
Good.
I haven't seen it in the feed, but I apologize if I've missed it. Would you consider covering Missy Bevers? Case that truly haunts me due to a killer being caught on camera in this surveillance video.
Oh, those always creep me out.
And they're still at large.
Yeah, that is scary.
Jessica has a theory of who the murderer is, but she'd love to hear our take on it. So Missy Bevers, in her case, she is a woman facing financial difficulty and marital discord. And in the days before her murders, she had received a creepy and strange message from an unknown man on LinkedIn.
Hmm.
She was killed early in the morning on April 18th by a person dressed in tactical clothing who broke into Creekside Church and fled before members of the Camp Gladiator fitness class arrived and found her body. She had multiple puncture wounds to the head and chest.
Huh.
Yeah. So that sounds weird enough.
I wonder how they know what the killer was wearing if she died and she was alone.
I know. I think we need to investigate this more.
All right. We'll look into it.
Put it down.
All right. I'm adding it in. Okay. And then I have a suggestion from Stephanie. I would like to see Dick and Jill cover the Austin, Texas case of Jennifer Cave. She was murdered by University of Texas student Colton Pitaniak, who was supposed to be her friend. It's a very sad but interesting story. And it does sound familiar to me, so I looked on Wikipedia, and it says it occurred in the West Campus area of Austin, Texas, on August 18, 2005, and her body was discovered. Jennifer originated from Corpus Christi, Texas. She was one of 5 girls in her family. She attended school in Bishop, Texas, before moving to Corpus Christi in 2000. In 2002, she graduated from Mary Carroll High School in Corpus Christi, and in August of that year, she traveled to San Marcos, Texas. to attend Texas State University as a finance major. Now, she dropped out after just one semester and worked at a restaurant in Austin, while briefly attending the Austin Community College. Before her murder, she began to work for a law firm as a legal assistant. So Colton Pitagnac was a finance major at the University of Texas at Austin. And before coming to Austin, he attended the Christ of Kings School and the Catholic School in Little Rock. He was a National Merit Scholar. And in the year 2000, he was one of seven senior finalists at the high school. So he was kind of a well-accomplished young man.
Sounds like.
But in 2004, police found cocaine, prescription sleeping pills that he had unlawfully obtained, and he was arrested for possession of illegal drugs. Now, he had no previous record of violent crime, and authorities said that Jennifer and Colton had no previous interactions. Seems like there was a lot going on here.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, that just touches the very surface, but...
Yeah, but that's, that's worthy of a look-see.
Yeah, I mean, this is really sad. Just a pretty young girl murdered.
Let's check it out.
Okay, we'll look into that one too.
Okay, final one.
Okay.
This is from Sandra. Love your podcast. I eagerly wait for yours to download each week. May I suggest the Delphi, Indiana murders of teenagers Abby and Libby? Unsolved murder that took place only a short time ago, and despite there being pictures and audio of the killer or killers. We need as much publicity as possible to seek justice for these darling girls and their families. So the quickie thing about this is February of this year, 2017. The bodies of Abby Williams and Libby German were discovered on an American hiking trail in Delphi, Indiana. So they were just off for the day to do a little hike. They disappeared from the same trail the previous day. The murders have received significant media coverage due to the fact that a photo and audio recording of a man believed to be the girl's murderer was found on the cell phone of Libby.
Yes, well, actually, since we got the feedback together, I've gotten several more letters about this case. Abby and Libby went missing on February 13th, and on the 14th, Valentine's Day, their bodies were found. Now, the next day, police released a photo of a man walking the trail at the time of the girl's disappearance. A 31-year-old man named Daniel Nations was arrested in Colorado last week, and he is a person of interest. He was arrested for not showing up to check in with his parole officer, and he is actually a convicted sex offender. So he was homeless, and he was in the Delphi area at the time of the girl's disappearance. So we'll keep our eye on this one, but hopefully if they've caught the perpetrator, the murderer.
I would hope. If they've got an audio and video recording.
And hopefully get a conviction.
Yeah.
That's a sad case, yeah. Okay, well, this was a great discussion, Dick. Thank you.
We're done for the day.
We're done for the day, and we'll get together again at the Quiet End soon.
I'm looking forward to it. Those guys are still doing flights.
Yeah, let's go join them.
I think that's a good idea.
I'm ready to wreck my palate.
Except I'm not going to do a flight.
I will.
Okay, you do a flight, I'll do a couple beers.
Okay, sounds good.
All right.
All right, goodbye, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, guys.